The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And greetings, everyone. I'm John Loeffler. Our guest today is Wade Pfau, 8 Core Ideas to Guide Retirement Income Planning. And by the time you've gotten done listening to today's program and last week's program, you will have heard 2 experts in retirement planning talking about the crisis that is upon us regarding retirement. Now, this hasn't come as any surprise. We've known that it's been coming for some time. Last week, we discussed why most plans fail, and today's retiree is facing issues that an earlier generation never thought of. For example, in today's environment of zero interest rates and now a world of negative interest rates, which look like they're on their way for us here, also because of advances in medicine, retirees are living longer, so they need to rely and draw down their assets over a longer time frame. So how many of you listening would have thought, let's say, well, maybe about 8 years ago, you'd be living in a 0% interest rate world just 8 years from that point? It's amazing how much has changed in the world in the first 15 years of the new century. Or even the fact that losing 45% during the final crisis, stocks would come roaring back 230% from the depths of the crisis. So what we need to discuss today is a different concept when it comes to planning for retirement. It's an approach that we believe works, which of course is always the ultimate point, and one in which the experts in retirement planning are also recommending. So we hope today's show changes your thinking about retirement. Now, having said all of that, Jim, where do we launch?
You know, I want to start out with a concept that I discussed with Professor Merton. Now, this is a guy that was a Nobel laureate. He got it for actually formulas on derivatives. And I discussed it on the program last week. John, let's go with that clip on what was traditionally been the three-legged stool of retirement.
You know, there are 3 sources of retirement funding: government, like Social Security, employer plans, such as either DB or DC, or personal saving. I don't think very many people are optimistic that government Social Security is going to be increased. We are mostly hoping it'll just at least not be decreased. Employer plans, as you already noted in your introduction, they got out of it because it was too expensive. So they clearly didn't replace it with a plan that has as much benefits in it as the old DB plans. So those have gone down, which means to maintain the benefits, the only way we can do that is either to save more personally, which is not an easy thing to do, or, as I could mention for a moment somewhere in the interview, there are some ways in which we can get some more benefits out of the assets we have. But that's just the basic thing. The other thing is that the good news, the next generations are going to live longer. That's the good news. The complication with that is that if you're going to live longer, we're going to have to be able to come up with more funding for retirement, or either work longer or live at a lower standard of living and save more. Those are, you know, invariant facts.
That was Professor Robert Merton. We were talking about what was considered the three-legged stool for retirement. And that was something, John, that was traditionally for our parents. We weren't having issues with retirement because they had a DB. When he was talking about DB, he meant a defined benefit pension plan. And that usually covered anywhere from 70 to 80% of your working salary. And then on top of that, you threw the second leg, which was Social Security. Most people that retired, I can remember when I got into the business in 1980, John, most people that retired, the combination of defined benefit pension plan and Social Security, many people were actually making more in retirement than where they were working, because number one, they didn't have to pay the Social Security tax anymore. And the combination of that pension plus the Social Security pretty much covered what they were earning while they were working. And then the third level, which was savings, and that's, you know, whatever you managed to save, whether it was an IRA or any kind of personal savings. And here's where the problem began. The crisis issue many retirees face in the private sector is, as Professor Merton talked about, defined benefit pension plans have been replaced by what we call defined contribution plans. And very few defined benefit plans are left in the private sector. Most defined benefit plans, if you see them today, are mainly in the government sector. And those plans are now in jeopardy, with many cities and states facing bankruptcy issues over pension obligations. So government defined benefit plans are going to be the next plans to be replaced by defined contribution plans. The government's already working on it because they know they've got a problem. They can't cover this. So the second leg that we're talking about, as you heard the professor talked about, which was Social Security, just got reduced for women and surviving spouses, and most people didn't even realize it. However, what pensions and defined benefits did in the past is they provided a degree of certainty in retirement. Now, only one leg of that stool is left, which is Social Security. And as Professor said, we're hoping that, you know, they maintain it. And I believe we will have Social Security. It's going to be modified as they just did last November, but it's going to be gradually less favorable as they just made those adjustments in November, but it'll be preserved contrary to predictions of its demise.
You know, Jim, I was actually thinking when you were talking there about people retiring early and they had defined plans, etc. A lot of people, if you recall, retired early, took their pensions from whatever their first career had been, and then started another job. So they had double levels of income, as a matter of fact. And at the time when you didn't have to pay any more on Social Security, there were all sorts of juggling that you can do, but a lot of that has gone away. But with defined benefit plans, a thing of the past, now, how do you create or replace that certainty? Because obviously when people get to retirement age, they want a certain level of certainty. They don't want that day-to-day angst like, are we going to have enough to make the bills next month? And there are very few things that are certain in this new investment world, the new normal that we're in.
There are a number of things you can still do, including one option we've often talked about in case studies here, which is basically extend your working career and you work longer. Number one, the advantages, your Social Security can grow at 8% a year the longer you prolong receiving it if you're working. And so that's one option, John. But before you even get to creating a secure retirement, there are a few important steps that really need to be done. Number one is an essential budget. I know we talk about this. I can't tell you how key this is to understanding your own retirement. Unless you know exactly what your basic expenses are, know what that number is, and kind of have a feeling of what kind of inflation rate you're experiencing, depending on where you live, this is really key before you even get to talking about producing income. A second thing is longevity in a healthcare budget. Most retirement plans I see do not take into account long-term care expenses, medical expenses. We've talked to a number of individuals, depending on what study you read, those expenses are anywhere from $230,000 to $250,000. So let's assume that an average couple will live 25 years in retirement. That is about $10,000 a year that needs to be included in the budget for healthcare expenses. That's the number that we use when we're doing financial plans, because everybody knows your spending pattern will change throughout retirement, maybe a lot more up front when you first retire. You take those vacations and do a lot of traveling. Then you kind of settle in the middle years of your retirement. And then the final years of your retirement, where you're going to be spending a lot more money on medical issues. But John, two types of budget that need to be addressed if you are to effectively plan for your own retirement.
Okay, let's talk about the issues. I mean, we often discuss budgets here, and we've interviewed a lot of experts on, well, for example, the healthcare field. Explain how the two actually integrate together, why they're both related, and why it is important when focusing on income.
I mean, the budget is important because you want to get as much secure income that you can find to make sure that your monthly expenses are covered. Examples of secured income would be, as that professor talked about, maybe you work for a government or you're one of the fortunate few that works for a corporation. There's still a few out there that have defined benefit pension plans, so that's secure. Social Security would be another form of secured income. A laddered bond portfolio versus a bond fund, as you'll see when we discuss this week's case study, and annuities. I mean, essentially what defined benefit pension plans are basically, in one sense, an annuity. Your company basically goes to an insurance company, depending on your age and that of your spouse, and they say, here's a pot of money we've accumulated and put aside for this employee. Given their age, you know, what are their options? And the insurance company will say, given that pot of money, here's what will be on the husband's life. Here's what will be on their joint life or a 50% survivor benefit. But essentially, those defined benefit pension plans were annuities. So annuities is another form of secured income. Really, when you boil this down, what you're trying to do is design a strategy that provides as much secure in certain income as possible. And securing predictable income goes a long way in bringing peace of mind to a retirement plan and its ultimate success. You don't want to leave your basic living expenses up to the vagaries of the stock market. So that is why we like, for example, laddered bonds and annuities. If there isn't a pension, or, for example, the assets aren't large enough to cover living expenses.
Okay, now what about healthcare expenses, which we know are rising at about 6% a year right now? The Obama administration, we're talking about Obamacare here, is floating a new rule to reduce doctor reimbursement for drugs to doctors. So further cuts to Medicare are coming, which means more out-of-pocket expenses for retirees. And they don't have any choice in this because the plan right now isn't sustainable the way it is.
No, and the second part of the budget plan is a real important one, and it's often ignored in retirement planning. And that's really to focus on longevity and healthcare costs. So rather than using government stats on longevity, what we do, John, is we use a software program that is designed by the medical field. And what we do is we have a health questionnaire, and it takes into account family history, personal health issues that you may have. And that better reflects a couple's longevity than, let's say, well, the government says a male age X lives to this age and a female lives to X age. This is important because you really need to know your chances, how long you're going to live, because income and assets will be needed rather than get surprised later on in life. You don't want to get yourself in a situation where, you know, John, I have clients in their late 80s. I have several clients right now that are in their 90s and are still active. One of them just took up, believe it or not, playing drums. I was just really surprised. I was tickled when I had a review with her and her children, but, you know, still active in her 90s. So it can also alter your investment mix in terms of, let's say, how much of your assets or dollars are put into one asset class, such as bonds versus stocks, or for, in some cases, an immediate annuity. I mean, in a perfect world and in a successful plan, you never want to run out of money, or, you know, find yourself in a situation where I've got a case right now where the mother is in a retirement home with Alzheimer's and the kids are all pitching in to take care of her. So you don't want to be dependent on your kids or face a lower standard of living or become a ward of the state. So these are things that have to be taken into consideration, and especially now with the dramatic changes that have occurred as a result of Obamacare that are still actually taking place with the president's new plan to cut drug reimbursement to doctors. And that's on a trial run. They're going to run it over a couple of years, but basically they're going to reduce payouts to doctors. And somewhere down the road, somebody's going to pick up the cost for that.
Okay, so we have a budget here and we know longevity ages. So then what comes next?
I mean, there are two additional items we need to deal with. One is what I call the bucket list. I mean, think of that, you know, toys, hobbies, travel, bequest, anything that you're thinking that you're going to do now that you're retired. A lot of people like to buy, you know, I have clients that have bought motorhomes, clients that have bought boats, various activities. One of my clients really got into photography, built sort of a studio. And of course, travel is very big on the list. You know, you no longer have to report for work or a time clock bequest. Maybe you want to give gifts to the kids or grandkids. So the bucket list would be one budget and then the healthcare budget. So now we have three components in a retirement plan. Your basic expenses. That's what it costs without travel or hobbies. This is what it costs you to live. Food, utilities, rent, running the cost of a house or maybe a retirement home where you have a payment, the bucket list, and then healthcare expenses. Then once we know what these numbers are, we can construct a portfolio mix that meets these issues. I mean, the basic expenses we always try to target with secure, predictable income. And for most people in the private sector today, that means just for most people, it's going to be Social Security. You know, some may have some kind of pension. I know some of the energy companies still, some of them out there have defined benefit pension plans, a laddered bond portfolio or annuity, because really what you're going for here is something that is predictable. You don't want to have any guesswork here. You know the check comes in every month. You know you're going to have that check to pay your bills. The healthcare in the bucket list, we usually recommend dividend-paying stocks because you have a built-in inflation hedge. And that's where you know, and especially today, where the risk of longevity comes into play. We know we're living longer, and we also know that the final third of our lives, medical expenses, are going to occupy a greater portion of the budget. We try to budget, we have found, given the longevity, given medical expenses, $8,000 to $10,000 a year is an appropriate figure to budget for medical expenses. And an inflation rate that's running 6 to 7%, we use a higher inflation rate because retirees will face higher medical expense inflation than other aspects of their budget. So this is a real inflation number that is experienced out there and documented. And so that's a number we like to use. And $8,000 to $10,000 is a number we're comfortable with. If you really think about it, that $230,000, the $250,000 number that studies have done that most people will spend out of pocket for medical expenses, that's roughly in an average retirement about $10,000 a year. We prefer dividend paying stocks for the savings element because only investments outside of real estate have an inflation hedge. And that's really what you're trying to get here. You want something, you have rental properties, you can raise the rents, you have dividend paying stocks, a good blue chip companies, they raise the dividends. And that's what you're really looking for. You're looking for an increased source of income because most of your basic expenses are going to come from fixed sources. Now, Social Security does have a COLA element to it, but everybody knows the COLA that they use or the cost of living and inflation rate they use for Social Security is probably a lot lower than what most people are experiencing in actual life. So you want an inflation hedge in something that is even to some extent predictable, and you can get that, especially when you're looking at blue chip stocks.
Now, let's take real estate. I mean, most people own some property. How does this factor in as part of the portfolio?
I mean, real estate investment income is a great inflation hedge, and a lot of people made a lot of money, including the current contender for the Republican nominee, Donald Trump, fortune in real estate. And I do have clients who have large real estate holdings. I prefer to use a real estate investment trust instead for a number of reasons. Number one, I've got liquidity. Number two, I can dispose of the real estate investment trust in one day if the markets become risky or, for example, we're heading into a recession. Think of what happened to commercial and residential real estate in the last downturn. Most clients, John, I've found, do not want the headaches of managing real estate as they age. One of my largest clients began to liquidate her real estate holdings after her husband died, so we didn't have to deal with any capital gains issues because all the real estate got stepped up to market value at his death. So all the depreciated value, which lowered the cost basis and the appreciation of the asset itself, that were forgiven at his death, so we didn't have to deal with large capital gains issue. The problem was she wanted to liquidate it. She's now 88 years old. She's living in a retirement home with possible dementia issues. And it took John nearly 3 years to liquidate the real estate. Part of that was due to the financial crisis, especially in the early years following the crisis, where it was difficult to get financing for buyers, and the real estate market wasn't a good market to be selling properties into. So that is an advantage of owning a real estate investment trust. They're liquid and can be disposed of quickly during a market downturn, or let's say, for example, a recession is coming, and you know, in a recession, a lot of things happen. Things lose their value, including real estate prices getting soft, as we saw in the last downturn. But yeah, real estate and probably dividend paying stocks are two inflation hedges, the ones that are more common that you use. And most people, John, do not want to be dealing with headaches of managing rental properties when they're retired. So that's one reason why we use real estate investment trust instead.
Okay, so the goal here then is to try to create certainty by targeting income that covers living expenses and then also takes into account inflation and rising medical costs. And I guess this takes a certain amount of skill or planning to do it. How would you say this approach differs then from standard retirement planning as we've known it?
I mean, the major difference, and you've all heard this, and we've in fact done a couple shows on what's your number. Most retirement plans focus on a number. They're saying, okay, you're age 25, 35, whatever your age is. You want to retire at age 65. This is the number you need to get. You need to get to X amount of assets. The problem with that is assets today do not buy the same income stream that assets bought, let's say, 5, 7, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, or 15 years ago. And I don't think that is an effective approach. And this was something that Professor Merton brought up when I interviewed him last week. And he talked about, and this really is he didn't realize it, but he was given a good example of financial repression. John, let's go to that Professor Merton clip, because this really demonstrates why focusing on income makes a lot more sense than focusing on an asset number.
If you had come 9 or 10 years ago to an advisor and said, I'm very unsophisticated, I don't like to take risk, I have $1 million, which is a lot of money, but I really need to live on it, put me in the safe thing. Well, if I wasn't thinking and I thought safety meant make sure that $1 million doesn't lose, I could have gone to a bank and gotten an insured deposit, certificate of deposit, full faith and credit of the government, and put your money in, and you would have earned maybe 4 or 5%, which means on your $1 million, your income would have been $40,000, $50,000 a year. Okay. What would you get for your $1 million in that same insured bank account today? 0.1%. That's $1,000 per million. $1,000 income on $1 million saving. So look at the situation. Between 9 years ago and now, we preserved $1 million. It's been absolutely safe through all the crises we've had. But what about your income? You used to get 40 or 50,000. Now you're getting 1,000. You can't remotely live on 1,000 if you were living on 40 or 50. So although your value changed not at all, the income fell 40-fold. It fell from 40 or 50 down to 1. I can't think of any more dramatic way to see how risky a asset that is very safe in terms of preserving your value is in terms of income. And you can't do both. You can either take safe income, where you lock in a guaranteed income, or you can have guaranteed or safe value. You can't have both.
And John, that's a good example. I mean, what he was really talking about was financial repression. And I gave an example. I think we've used this over a number of times on the show. And I went back to the year 2000. If you came to me and said, I want $3,000 a month, I want something that's completely safe, I don't want any risk, I don't want any fluctuation, you know, I could have put that in a 2-year treasury note and only taken about $540,000. Today, it would take over $5 million. So almost tenfold more in assets to produce the same level of income. And that's why we take a target income approach. And I think that's the more efficient and correct way to do retirement planning. Because after all, folks, when you retire, what are you going to live on? You're living on income. And that's why the emphasis needs to shift, I believe, in our industry from a school of thought of focusing on, let's say, an asset number, in focusing more on an income number. What level of income am I going to have, or what level of income will I need when I retire? And I think that the emphasis has to change in that direction.
Yeah, but all of these software programs in the industry still are always talking about the number. I mean, like there have been commercials. What's your number? I remember seeing those. You know, what's your number? Can you do it? And blah, 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 as if this is going to be formula rather than projecting where the trends are and then how you can meet those trends.
Yeah, I just don't think it's a very effective approach. I mean, if we were living in a normal market like we were in the 80s and 90s and probably the first part of the last decade, John, I would say you could do that. But even remember in the last decade, Greenspan brought interest rates down to 1%, which is why a lot of money went into real estate and a lot of money went back into the stock market because people were looking for higher returns. You don't want to keep your money in the bank at 1%. I mean, you know, 1%. Sounds incredible today when you're thinking of what you're getting. I mean, a 3-month treasury bill is still a quarter of 1%. And a 2-year treasury note has gone up recently. And we talked a little bit about that on the weekend program. But even there, John, it's still less than 1%. And people can't survive on a 1% income return. So that's why, as Professor talked about there, yeah, if you had $1 million 7-8 years ago and you preserved it, I don't know, maybe kept it in a bank or a CD, just think of every time you rolled over that bank CD, unless you locked it in for a long period of time when interest rates are high, you've seen your income roll over and progressively get worse as the Fed has brought interest rates down. And with all these QE programs that we've got going on with negative rates in Europe, negative rates in Japan, we've seen interest rates come down year after year. So the picture for most individuals has actually gotten a lot worse. And that's why I think the emphasis on planning needs to shift more on focusing on income rather than assets.
So covering up the three things that we have covered here, you do need a basic budget. Then you need a bucket list of things that you want to do over and above the budget. This is your basic core planning idea. And you have to factor in healthcare expenses as you get older and do all of this in the light of where the trends are going with interest rates and investments. So ultimately, focus more on your income versus your assets. That keeps you focused on what is really important as far as your retirement planning. Now, what we do every week here on the program, I'm sure you know that by now if you've listened to the show, we have a real-life case study to illustrate those things which are under discussion right now. As I said, they're a real-life study, but we changed the names of the people involved to protect their privacy.
In the case study this week, we're going to call John and Helen Sutton, both age 67, John age 67, Helen age 67 as well, both retired. The issues that we were really dealing here, there were 4 or 5 issues. One was John's health. He had a heart attack 2 or 3 years ago. The other thing, when it came to longevity, his dad passed away at 68. John's 67, has heart issues, although he's taken care of it with medication and diet. Helen had the better genes between the two of them. Her family lives into their late 80s. So that was issue number one, longevity for Helen versus shorter longevity for John, especially with his medical issues. The second thing were investment mistakes. They got out of the market in 2009. Basically seeing, you know, a major drop in their asset holdings in their IRA. And they mainly went into cash and bonds, primarily bond funds. And the issue with the bond funds is the bond funds in 2009 were paying a higher interest rate than, let's say, what bond funds are paying today. And a lot of that is a result of what we've seen of this global QE that we've seen first initiated by the Fed and other central banks. So even though they were in bond funds, they saw their income decline every year. They had no stocks other than the stock of the company that John worked for. The third issue that we were dealing with were expenses and income gap. I mean, they had enough income coming in to cover their basic living expenses. Where they had issues was what I call the bucket list and also budgeting enough money put aside for healthcare, because healthcare expenses were real, especially to John and then also to Helen, given longevity that ran in her family. Now, one of the things that they did to raise assets, and especially when the housing market improved here in Southern California, is they sold their house, downsized, paid cash for a townhouse, and that freed up about $700,000. I mean, they lost a lot of money in the financial downturn, close to 35% of their assets in their retirement plan during that decline. And so what they did is they no longer needed the big house. When the markets improve, they sold their house and that freed up some cash. Now, looking at their basic expenses and their budget, their base budget was around $70,000 a year to live, $20,000 for travel expenses, and then we put in $10,000 for medical. So their total expenses were about $90,000 a year. That may sound a lot for people that live in, let's say, the South or the Midwest, but $90,000 in California doesn't buy you much. John's Social Security was $2,480 a month. That was roughly about $30,000 a year. Helen got half of that. That was about $1,240. So that was almost $15,000. So roughly almost $45,000 a year coming in from Social Security. In John's IRA, he had $650,000 in an IRA in a bond fund, which he was drawing out because he needed to live on. Helen's IRA was roughly about $130,000. So they had almost $800,000 in bond funds in their IRAs. That was producing roughly almost $23,000 a year. The $700,000 that they got from the excess money from the sale of their house, that was producing around 1% at the bank. That was about $7,000. John's company stock, there was worth roughly about almost $100,000. That was producing about 3% dividends, that is, so about $2,700 a year. So total investment income was $32,300. His Social Security was roughly almost $45,000. So they were producing roughly about $77,000, not quite enough. And one of the issues that they had was not only did they not have enough money for what I call the bucket expense items, but they had seen their income decline just about every single year from dividends in their bond fund. So they really weren't keen. I mean, they were a little bit nervous, obviously, about the stock market having lost nearly 35% during the financial downturn. But even more disturbing was the fact that even bond funds can go down. And also, more importantly, what they experienced personally was the decline in the dividends as interest income from the dividends came down as interest rates came down.
Yeah, well, given all of these needs which were tugging on them, what was the solution?
We took the $700,000 and we put it into a joint annuity on John and Helen's life, and that would produce $3,500 a month or $42,000 a year for as long as John and Helen lived. If both of them passed away within a 10-year period, the balance would be paid to their estate. We took $400,000 and put it in a laddered bond portfolio with a 4%, averaging roughly about 4%. That was $16,000 a year. And then we put $380,000 in blue chip stocks. You know, I had to talk to John and I go, look, you held on to your company's stock. It went down during the market downturn, but look where that company stock is today. You have to have something in here for expenses. And don't forget the annuity, which is based on your life and your wife's life. Remember, when both of you are gone, that's gone. There's nothing that's going to come back to the estate. And especially on Helen's side, where they tend to live longer in her family, you have to have something to protect for inflation, especially long-term care, should that be needed down the road, or increasing medical expenses, which, you know, they had a bit of that with John's medical condition. So the total investment income would be roughly almost $70,000 a year, $44,000 from Social Security, $114,000 a year, enough left over to build a future income stream. And more importantly, for both of them, total investment assets were roughly about $1.6 million, and safe, certain, or guaranteed assets were really $1.1 million, or 70% of their portfolio. So as I talked about, John, look, 70% of your portfolio is locked in. It's guaranteed, a laddered bond portfolio. The bonds mature. The income doesn't change. You get your money back in 4% in today's market. And actually, as some of these bonds roll over, we'll probably be getting even a higher interest rate. You can afford to keep some blue chip stocks with rising dividends because your lifestyle is not going to be affected by if Janet Yellen raises interest rates, we get into a recession, or we have another bear market in stocks.
Well, you can see what they were doing here. They'd lost money in the stock market. They'd watched income from bonds go down. And the last thing you want to do is be in retirement and see that happen again, because then you wonder, well, jeepers, what am I going to do? And that's what they were searching there. So that's what you were trying to address.
I mean, he didn't want to put it all into bonds. A little bit of what I call some hesitancy at first. Helen was perfectly comfortable with bonds, but based on the decline in income that they've seen from their bond funds, you know, I really had to show them, look, if you buy a bond and you put $10,000 in the bond and it pays 4%, it's going to pay 4%. It doesn't change. That's the difference between owning individual bonds versus, let's say, a bond fund, which, you know, there aren't any guarantees in terms of maturity or what the income's going to be. So that took something, and that's why the annuity was more appealing, because it was a check coming in. Part of it was principal, and that's an issue and one of the reasons why we wanted to still have money in the stock market, because we did want to build an asset base and a rising income stream. But really what they wanted the most, more than anything else, and especially John, was a degree of predictability and certainty that they hadn't experienced since they retired or planning for retirement during the financial crisis. And, you know, people, John, are still affected by that today, because there's still a lot of people out there in bond funds and cash that never really got back into the market. And a lot of people that have kept money in cash and they've sat on the side, just like Professor Merton talked about. You take a look at what you're getting on a bank deposit today compared to what you got 5, 6, 7 years ago, or for that matter, at the beginning of the century.
And coming up next, our guest of the week, Wade Fowle, 8 core ideas to guide retirement income planning as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, it's no secret that the largest population in American history is heading into retirement. But many people are ill-prepared to face a third of their lifetime, as much as 25 years that you could spend in retirement. Joining me on the program is Professor Wade Fowle. He is a professor of retirement income at American College. And Professor, you recently wrote a paper called 8 Core Ideas to Guide Retirement Income Planning. And the first step in that process or a theme is play the long game. In other words, retirement plan should be based on planning to live, because we know that a couple age 65 could spend between 25 years of their lifetime in retirement rather than planning to die. Explain what you mean by that, and what does this entail when you talk about playing the long game?
Right. So, I mean, I think people really understand this idea, but they get caught up in the heat of the moment and sometimes forget about it. So one example of this would be claiming Social Security benefits. And it's very common, about half of the population claims as early as they can at age 62, because they're really thinking in their mind, they're worried that they're not going to live very long, and they feel like they would lose out on their Social Security if they delayed claiming. You can delay until age 70, and if they did that and then died at 68 or 69, they really would have missed out on their Social Security benefits. But that kind of thinking is really planning to die rather than planning to live. And you're not really going to be all that much worse off if you delay Social Security. And I mean, you are worse off because you die early, but in terms of your financial picture, that will be a less expensive retirement. It should financially have worked out okay. The issue is really, if you do end up living into your 80s or 90s, then you really have a lot of efficiencies if you start early by thinking about long-term strategies, strategies that may only pay off if you do live a long time, putting that kind of groundwork into place that can really help you to enjoy a better retirement throughout.
Professor, why do you think it is? I've interviewed Yolanda York from Social Security here on the program, and she has pointed out the same statistic that the average American starts taking benefits at age 62, which is a reduced benefit versus waiting to, let's say, full retirement age or even allowing it to accumulate to age 70. Why do you think that is? Is it a lack of education, or they're not working with an advisor? Is it simply not knowing the facts?
Yeah, I think in the past it was partly a lack of education. Actually, in the last couple of years, you can start to see a slow change in the trend where there are people delaying. But it's partly a concern that Social Security is going to disappear, so you should get whatever you can out while you still can, and I think that concern is overblown. Part of it, I think, is just this short-sightedness that people are not playing the long game. They're just thinking, well, why would I give up some money today? And the reason you might do so is because over the long term, it could really benefit you, but it's not going to benefit you for quite a while. And I think that short-sightedness really becomes a big issue as well.
Let's talk about one of the second themes in long-term retirement planning, and you call it, do not leave money on the table, because the holy grail of retirement income planning is finding strategies that enhance retirement efficiency. What should be done here? And explain that term, do not leave money on the table. I mean, does that mean die with no money left in the estate? Explain that.
No, that's not really what I had in mind. That's more just looking for efficiencies. I started my career as an economist, and for an economist, if you have two goals, goal one being meet your spending goals in retirement, goal two, preserving liquidity, if there's a strategy that allows you to spend more but still keep the same amount of assets left in your portfolio, or otherwise you spend the same amount but can have more assets left over, then strategies that allow you to do that, or to even combine the two, be able to spend more and preserve more assets, those are defined as more efficient strategies. And there can be opportunities where it's just a matter of doing things that otherwise you're leaving money on the table. So for individuals who are not super wealthy, there's the issue that in retirement, you can have more than $90,000 of total income before you leave the 15% tax bracket. And so any sort of capital gains you have as a part of that, around $96,000, is going to be a 0% tax rate. The capital gains tax rate is 0% until you leave the 15% tax bracket. So if you're retired, you no longer have labor income, maybe your Social Security benefits or other income sources add up to $50,000 or $60,000, for example, you then have that capacity to have $30,000 or $40,000 of capital gains taxed at a 0% tax rate. And if you don't take advantage of that, it disappears. And that's what I mean about leaving money on the table. Pay your taxes at a 0% tax rate now instead of later having to pay at a higher tax rate.
There are a number of things we talked about there, and this relates to, I guess, a third theme that you emphasize here, and that is use reasonable expectations for portfolio returns. And I know historically, if you look at the stock market, you know, over the last 100 years, it's returned almost 100%, but that includes dividends reinvested. Today, Professor, we live in a zero interest rate world. In fact, in many parts of the world, it's a negative interest rate world. We've seen, for example, in 2015, the stock market go nowhere, or for that matter, from 2000 to 2013, the stock market went nowhere. So what is a reasonable rate of return in terms of expectations when you want to realistically plan your retirement? I mean, what figures would you use?
Well, on the stock side, it is a lot more controversial. The discussion's actually a lot easier on the bond side, because bonds, there's just a mathematical formula that based on today's interest rates and the future bond payments, you can figure out, well, if you hold the bond to maturity, today's yield is going to be its return. And one of the biggest pet peeves I have is a lot of the financial planning software out there that people are using, the Monte Carlo simulation type software, the assumptions it uses for the financial plan are to just plug in the historical averages and then have volatility around those. But that means you're plugging in intermediate-term government bonds, for example, 5.5% or 6% returns. And that's really mathematically impossible when you're starting from this situation where even 10-year treasuries now are under 2%. If interest rates go up, you have capital losses on bond funds, or if you sell the bonds before their maturity date. The only way you could have returns higher than today's interest rates is to have interest rates continue to fall, and they can only fall so far. So a lot of the software, unfortunately, is plugging in, say, 3 or 4% higher returns on the bond side than are just mathematically feasible. And that should also impact the stock side as well, because if bond returns are lower, you need to expect stock returns to be lower as well, or otherwise the premium that stocks earn above bonds would be higher. And I haven't seen any compelling argument about why stock returns would be higher in the future. Most of the issues around stock markets do seem overvalued. if anything, we should expect lower returns rather than higher returns. The reason it matters more for retirement than for pre-retirement is the market returns over the next few years are the key market returns that will matter for a retirement plan. For someone who's still, say, 30 years from retirement, today's market returns hardly matter at all. It's going to be the market returns 30 years from now that matter. And so they can get away with using these historical averages to guide their simulations, since it really doesn't make much difference. But for people at retirement, it makes a big difference. And it really impacts something like the 4% retirement spending rule. If you plug in the historical averages, it gives you a 95% chance that it will work. But if you do some sort of adjustments to reflect the lower interest rate world that we're in, you may see success rates closer to 70%. And then it's clearly not as safe as people have been led to believe.
Yeah, because, I mean, you take, for example, Professor, somebody that retired, let's say, in the year 2000. We had just come off double-digit returns in the stock market in the 90s. We had interest rates that were at 5, 6, 7% back then. Just think if you went into a bond fund and saw your dividends decline over the next decade, or for that matter, two bear markets in stocks where stocks lost 45% of their value. Those kind of statistics were not modeled into most financial planning software. I mean, they use historical returns of 10% on the market. And even here in my own state of California, CalPERS is still modeling 7 and 8% returns on their pension when there's nowhere near that kind of return in the markets today.
Right. Yeah. Pension funds tend to have too high of estimates as well. And it's basically the same problem. All this software out there, all this advice is assuming higher returns than are really mathematically feasible, at least on a sustained basis, when you are in such a low interest rate world. And if you assume a higher return, it makes you think you can spend more. And that can get you into trouble because you spend more today in anticipation of getting higher returns to justify that higher spending. And when those returns don't come, you've got to make a bigger cut to the spending in the future to get back on track.
So let's go to your fourth theme, which is be careful about plans that only work with higher market returns. I recently just took on a client who had a financial plan that was based on these historical high returns, and obviously it didn't take into account what happened in 2008, or for that matter, the 0% interest rate environment that we've been living in for almost 7 or 8 years. So what does a person need to be cognizant of in terms of these kind of plans? And are there plans out there that are more realistically adjusted? I mean, we use more realistic figures. We adjust our own planning assumptions on inflation, bond returns, and stock market returns that kind of reflect the reality in the world that we live in today.
Right. And if your plan can work with lower return assumptions, then you have a more robust plan that can deal with these types of issues. If basically the only way your plan can work is to get a high market return because you have to spend a lot relative to your assets to make the plan work, then you're really at that point just rolling the dice and hoping you actually get those high market returns. I mean, the difference between Monte Carlo simulations and a spreadsheet, if you're just building the plan in a spreadsheet, with the Monte Carlo simulations, you are getting the volatility. But with a spreadsheet, if you plug in the historical average returns, even if that's right, ignoring this other issue I've been talking about the impact of low interest rates, even if that's right, you still at that point only have a 50% chance for success. Because it's the average return. Half of the time it's less, half of the time it's more. And that's still jeopardizing the plan. I use the term amortizing the upside. You spend more because you assume you're going to get a high return in the future. So you're spending some of those future returns today before you get them. And that really just leaves you vulnerable if the plan's not going to work, if you don't get those higher returns. And so you are taking a lot of risk with that. And for some people, that might be fine to take that sort of risk, but certainly not for the typical retiree who's more vulnerable to their standard of living being impacted by market volatility.
And this comes to a fifth point that you bring up, which I think takes into consideration the kind of environment that we're living in today, and that is building an integrated strategy to manage various retirement risks. Because when we think of risk, we think, okay, stock market fluctuating. But retirement risks today include longevity because people are living longer. I mean, if you take a look at Social Security, when it first was put into effect in 1933, the average lifespan of a male was 65. Today, it's closer to 85. So there's longevity risk. There's market volatility. There's macroeconomic risk. There's inflation. And then also, Professor, there could be spending shocks that can derail a budget, especially in the latter years, where you're more likely to spend more money on health care, medical care, or, God forbid, long-term care.
Right. And these are fundamentally different types of shocks, the longevity risk, the market, macroeconomic type risks, and then the spending risks. They're different in their natures, and they require different approaches to manage them. And that's where this building an integrated retirement strategy, you need to have some part of your balance sheet that's meant to deal with the market risk. You need something on your balance sheet that's designed to deal with the longevity risk, and you need something in your balance sheet that's designed to deal with unexpected contingencies for long-term care costs. For some people, end up being zero, but for someone who has a prolonged stay in a nursing home due to dementia or Alzheimer's, at the extreme, it could cost more than $1 million. And those are the types of contingencies that you need to have an integrated strategy that has something built in to deal with all these very different types of risks. It's not just market risk or market volatility. There's more to the puzzle in retirement.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've seen often ignored in most retirement plans is medical expenses. You know, I've read studies, depending on whose study you're reading, that the average couple could plan on shelling out anywhere from $230,000 to $250,000 out of pocket for medical expenses during their lifetime in retirement.
Yeah, and usually those estimates are the average. So there's a lot of variation around that number. But yeah, the average out-of-pocket expenses could be in that ballpark range, definitely.
Well, let's move on to your sixth theme, which is approach retirement income tools with an agnostic view. And I'd like to bring this up because if you watch cable television, you have two points of view. You have commercials saying that annuities are bad and they're the worst thing for investment. And then you have other commercials that are saying that these are wonderful tools that could help an individual in retirement. And you talk about that usually the financial service profession is divided into two camps. One camp is focusing on investment solutions, and the other one is focusing on insurance solutions. Explain how to bridge the gap between the two and take a more an objective view to a solution.
Yeah, there's the old saying that like, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail. And that's kind of the issue. People on the financial services on the investment side, the only tool they have available is investment. So the solution for everything is build an investment portfolio for it. On the insurance side, people only selling insurance, the solution for everything is build an insurance solution. But it's the integrated strategies that time and time again in the research I've done show to be the most efficient types of strategies that you combine insurance and investments. You get the downside protection. You get the stable income from the insurance and the longevity protection. And then you get the upside growth potential and the ability to try to manage inflation risk and that sort of thing from the investment side. And by putting the two together, it really makes a difference. You can get more efficient retirement outcomes. And the simple way to describe this whole process is rather than having a retirement portfolio consist of stocks and bonds, I think the more efficient type of solution is stocks and income annuities. That income annuities replace bonds in the retirement income portfolio. Because income annuities, this is like a single premium immediate annuity. They're not a very big part of the market, only about 4% of annuity sales. And it's the very simple, lowest commission version of an annuity. But it's invested in an underlying bond portfolio, and it provides payments linked to your longevity. So the longer you live, the more expensive your retirement, and the more income you receive from the income annuity. It's a much more effective, quote-unquote, bond for retirement income. Again, the simple way to bridge the gap is instead of thinking in terms of, well, not thinking in terms of just annuities, not thinking in terms of just stocks and bonds, but stocks and income annuities for retirement.
You know, it's amazing because, Professor, at one time, most corporations, and well, the government still does, had something called the defined benefit pension plan, which was really a form of an immediate annuity. And even though corporate defined benefit plans have been replaced by contribution plans, that was a stable form of retirement where you knew that you were going to get a check. You knew what that check was going to be. It was always there. It didn't go down like a bond fund when interest rates came down, and it was dependable and predictable. And that's why, at least in your work, and I've seen studies as well done by others that are saying that this is a very viable tool in today's environment.
Yeah, I think so. And sometimes you hear the argument that in a low interest rate world, it's a bad idea to get an income annuity. But I think the opposite is really true, because in a low interest rate world, for somebody who's already retired and having to spend their assets, the mortality credit component, the idea that the reason income annuities work is because you're basically contributing to a pool and accepting the idea that if you don't live long, your principal will subsidize those who do end up living longer. And when you don't know which group you fall into in advance, that can be a good deal, because then everyone gets paid like they actually live to their life expectancy, rather than having to assume they're going to live to age 95 or whatever the case may be, and spread out their assets further. And so that pooling aspect becomes all the more valuable in a low interest rate world. Because with bonds, you are getting no interest income. With the annuity, you're also getting very little interest income, but you're getting these mortality credits that can be very valuable in the low interest rate world. And so, yeah, that's how you get that longevity protection and get that stable floor of income for retirement.
Your seventh point, which is start with a household balance sheet. I mean, anybody that's in the financial business, if I was analyzing a company to invest in a stock, I'm going to look at the financial statements, which includes the income statement, but also includes the balance sheet, because I want to know the financial health of a company. You say a retirement plan should begin with the balance sheet. Explain what you mean there and what's important to derive from that balance sheet. Obviously, it's a snapshot of what your net worth is, your liabilities, and the assets that you have to work with.
Yeah, so for the household balance sheet, the assets and the liabilities I think of as basically any type of financial goal for retirement. And a lot of these will be streams of spending that you want to do over retirement, so you need to take the present values of everything. But your fixed expenses in retirement, basic living needs, taxes, debt repayment, discretionary expenses, travel, leisure, and so forth. Contingencies, so what are you going to do to deal with long-term care, health care, and that sort of thing. And then any legacy goals as well. Those are the liabilities. And then the retirement income problem is really about rearranging or repositioning your assets in such a way to match them to these different types of liabilities and to match the risk characteristics. And so these assets, human capital, it's if you are going to have part-time work or some kind of continuing work in retirement, that's your earnings from working, your home equity, your financial assets, the checking accounts, brokerage accounts, retirement plans, IRAs, 401ks, and so forth, any insurance or annuities that you hold, and then also social capital, which is things like your Social Security benefits, your Medicare, any of those defined benefit pensions for those who still have those, and also family and community support. And how do you just, you got to then think about how to match those assets to the different liabilities and make sure you've got something in mind for how to cover all the different liabilities in your retirement.
And that includes, once again, going back to the two philosophies on retirement planning, one an investment approach, one's an insurance approach, is to make sure that those longer-term issues that come about with longevity, like medical expenses, are taken care of. Let's move on to your final point, and that is distinguish between technical liquidity and true liquidity. Explain what you mean by that for our listeners.
I think there's an important distinction here about liquidity. So, for example, suppose someone believes in the 4% rule for retirement and they want to spend $40,000 plus inflation and they have $1 million in their investment portfolio. Do they have any liquidity or not? Well, in some sense, you could say they have $1 million of liquidity. They can rebalance their portfolio and so forth. But I think in the truly meaningful sense, there's no liquidity there. Because basically, you have to earmark that entire $1 million to cover the $40,000 spending objective. And you could spend that money on something else, but doing so would risk jeopardizing the ability to meet your spending goal throughout retirement. And so in that regard, you don't have true, meaningful liquidity there. how might you get some true meaningful liquidity? Well, the part of the idea behind the 4% rule is you have to assume you're going to live a long time, well beyond life expectancy. It's a 30-year retirement for a 65-year-old. It's not so conservative anymore, but when that 4% rule was developed, it was meant to be conservative. There was a pretty small probability of living longer than 30 years. And that's the way you're managing that longevity risk, by having to spend conservatively. And that eats away at your potential to have this liquidity. The way to have true liquidity is to pool some of that longevity risk, get the higher payout rate from the income annuity, and then, though the income annuity is not liquid in the sense that you can't rebalance it or whatever you want to do, it's now locking in part of your assets to cover your spending goal. Set that aside, and if you could buy that annuity to get that $40,000 of income for, say, $700,000, and you probably wouldn't want to annuitize this much in reality, but for the simple example, then you still have this $300,000 left over, then you could say that that $300,000 has true liquidity. It really is liquid in the sense that it's no longer earmarked for meeting a particular goal. You can then use it for what you want to. And that's the idea of true liquidity.
So given where we are today, Professor, we live in a world where we're seeing, and throughout much of the world, like in Europe and Asia, we're seeing negative interest rates. We have low interest rates here. We've had two bear markets. So a lot of the assumptions that are built into a lot of retirement programs aren't necessarily true in this kind of environment. We have the issue that people are living longer today than, let's say, in the past. And then we also have a division within the financial service industry, as you pointed out. One side looks at investments as the sole means of creating a solution. The other side focuses on insurance. How do you create a balance, or how does an individual walk away with knowing that they have the best kind of plan that takes into account different forms of risk, longevity, all the things that one is likely to face throughout a 25-year retirement period?
Well, I think that can still be a challenge. It's really only been the past 10 years where financial planning has started to recognize that the retirement income planning is different from traditional wealth management. And for example, CFPs learn about the main financial planning designation. They learn about retirement planning, but it's all about pre-retirement, different types of qualified plans for saving for retirement. Retirement income is still new for a lot of people, but there is training out there for advisors. The American College, for example, has the RICP designation now, Retirement Income Certified Professional, that's teaching advisors about retirement income and how to build these types of integrated comprehensive strategies to manage all these different retirement risks while trying to also meet different goals at the same time. And working with someone like that, I think, can be an avenue forward. Someone who ultimately, there's a lot of different ways that financial advisors get compensated, and really there's no good method that purely is going to work for retirement income at this point in time. Advisors who are traditionally thought of as being independent, fee only charging their clients, not receiving any sort of commissions or anything, well, they have an incentive to keep the financial portfolio as big as possible, and that's not in the best interest of someone trying to sustain income for their lifetime. And of course, on the purely commission-driven side, that's not necessarily a working model either. So there's still going to be some upheaval and turmoil as we figure out how to do what is the best way to serve individuals for retirement income, and to make sure they do have strategies that integrate insurance and investments. And it's the advisors who are willing to draw from both who I think are ultimately going to be able to most serve their clients.
Well, listen, Professor, if our listeners would like to find out more about the articles and the things that you do in retirement planning, being a specialist, and read some of the articles as the one we just discussed, how could they find out more?
I have a website. It's all one word, retirementresearcher.com. And everything I write tends to be posted there as well, in addition to wherever else that it shows up. And so that's the great place to check first.
Well, listen, Professor, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. All the best, and come back and talk to us again.
Okay, my pleasure.
Interesting, the conversation you had with Wade Fowl, because it was the same as with Robert Merton. They were both emphasizing focus upon income as your metric for planning everything else.
you've got two schools of thought within the investment field. You have the investment community that says, look, investments are the solution to everything, to anything you need in retirement. Then you have the insurance industry that says, no, you know, you need to have guarantees and insurance. And really what you need is a balance or a merger between the two. And in this case, that's what this couple wanted. John wanted something that was predictable. He didn't want to go through another stock market downturn and be impacted by a severe loss of assets, nor did he ever want to be impacted by seeing his income decline each year, as so many people have seen as a result of financial repression and where interest rates are today. And think about the next recession. If we actually get to negative interest rates, don't think that can't come here. It happened in Japan after two decades of almost zero interest rates, and it's happening now in Europe with the European Central Bank last week making negative rates even more and increasing the amount of QE to 80 billion euros per month, almost just like what the Fed was doing when it initiated QE3. Interesting, John, how this world is really turned upside down when it comes to retirement planning. I compare that to today, what we're doing today compared to where I got into the business over 35 years ago when people were walking out with defined benefit pension plans, Social Security, cost of living increases were going up 6-7%. I can't tell you the number of clients that were back then telling me, yeah, I'm making more retired than I did when I was working and my take home's better because I'm not paying that 7.65% Social Security tax. So different world that we live in today. Well, speaking of a different world, we have a different time and we've run out of time, unfortunately. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.